Hello, this is the November 24th edition of the Fort Dodge Messenger. The front article is titled All in the Family. F.D. Ford Manor Owner, Thanksgiving Dinner Likely the Largest Ever. It's sort of surrounded by photos. One is of a man in a red vest and flannel with a Santa Claus hat on. He has a white beard and long white hair. It's titled, Volunteer Gary Edgerton of Fort Dodge got into the spirit of the current holiday. In the next one, Thursday, at the annual community Thanksgiving dinner at Fort Dodge Ford Lincoln Toyota. There's another photo of a woman in an apron and sort of like a blue cloth wrapped around her head. She's wearing glasses, has gloves, and she's putting food on a plate with tongs and like a buffet situation. That's captioned, Iowa Central Culinary Arts student Ava Korpman adds one of the first menu items to a guest plate Thursday during the annual community Thanksgiving dinner at Fort Dodge Ford Lincoln Toyota. And beneath this photo is another of a woman with short cropped hair, a green flannel. On her lap is a little boy, in a green hoodie, and they're both looking down at their food. It's captioned, as he works on a slice of turkey, Milo Wilkerson, 4, of Duncobb, contemplates a bit of sweet potato to his mom, Toddie Svoboda, is offering him during the community Thanksgiving dinner Thursday at Fort Dodge Ford Lincoln Toyota. The article goes, most of the time, the showroom at Fort Dodge Ford Lincoln Toyota is filled with shiny new cars and trucks waiting for their new owners. But for one day a year, that showroom becomes a family room for Deb and Casey Johnson and their incredibly large extended family. All 2,500 of them. The annual Fort Dodge Ford Community Thanksgiving dinner was served Thursday after Iowa Central Community College culinary arts students spent the last week preparing for the ginormous meal. Like every year, dozens of volunteers stepped up to help set up for the dinner, serve beverages, clean up, and deliver meals to homebound residents. The day starts in the kitchens at Iowa Central's Hanson Center, where the culinary students man the ovens and stoves, cooking pans and pans of Thanksgiving turkey and fixings. Next to the kitchen, volunteers from campus and the community set up an assembly line filling to-go boxes for the 1,014 homebound residents who requested a meal to be delivered by the 16 delivery teams. This is going to continue to page 4. We had 2 packaging lines in the kitchen, so it went really, really quick, said Barb Michaels, finance administrator at Fort Dodge Ford and organizer of the dealership's Thanksgiving dinner. We never ask for volunteers, they just show up. The Fort Dodge Ford dinner has been a community tradition for well over a decade now, and each year it runs even smoother than the year before, said Nancy Lombard, who also works in the dealership office and organizes the event with Michaels. Each year it gets better because we try to tweak it to make the process easier, quicker, less chaotic, Lombard said. But doesn't coordinating the delivery of more than 1,000 meals to homebound residents sound chaotic anyway? We have a list of good drivers that we contact every year, Lombard said. It's really nice when we get the same people, things just click. Michaels and Lombard began making calls on November 1st from residents requesting the delivery, Lombard said. Julie Pitten and her family were 2 of the delivery teams on Thursday. I think it's a good experience and it's great for the kids, she said. We actually had the privilege today to make meals out to the TSA workers at the airport. As much as we complain about hanging out with the family, we're really blessed to be able to do so. Pitten's 8-year-old daughter, Emmy, was excited to volunteer to deliver meals. I like helping people because not all people get to come out of their homes to get their own food, she said. The Pittens also delivered meals to First Baptist Church's Salt Center or people in need in the downtown area can go for warmth and support. I think it just speaks volumes about our sense of community and the kindness of the people of Fort Dodge and how willing they are to help those in need, Michael said of the volunteers who help each year. There's more positive things in Fort Dodge, if people choose to find them, as opposed to all the other things that are bad that happened that everyone seems to focus on. Lombard said, added, the 14 culinary students spent about a week preparing for Thursday's dinner, said Chef Michael Hurst, director of the culinary program. The students did everything from butchering the 70 turkeys to peeling 425 pounds of Yukon gold potatoes and slicing 250 pounds of Brussels sprouts to roasting the turkey bones to make broth for dressing and gravy. They whipped up about 6 quarts of cream this morning for the pies, Hurst added. A native of England, Hurst doesn't have a deep connection to Thanksgiving that most Americans do, but enjoys his role in this holiday tradition. It's a lot of fun that so many people give up their time and come and help out, he said. It brings people together, and at a time when there's a lot of people who are sort of backstabbing each other and being crappy to each other, it's kind of fun that people pull together for this. Across town at the dealership, rows and rows of tables filled the showroom floor. It was overwhelming and probably the largest ever, owner Casey Johnson said. In addition to the 1,014 meals that were delivered, there were about 1,300 to-go meals picked up by community members who came into the showroom but didn't stay to eat there. Overall, between the meals that were taken to go and the meals that were eaten at the dealership, Johnson estimates close to 2,500 people stopped in on Thursday. Several years ago, the Johnson's holiday dinner sparked the resurgence of another program for homebound residents. Meals on Real Wheels came out of this, Michael said. As we started doing all of these deliveries, we had a discussion about the number of homebound people that had to be in Fort Dodge that we had no services for. That's what made Deb and Casey then start the Meals on Wheels program. In 2017, Deb Johnson was a secretary of the Fort Dodge Community Foundation and United Way Board, and after learning that the Meals on Wheels program was just barely limping along after its longtime facilitator, North Central Home Care, closed in late 2013, Webster County Public Health was able to take on some of the Meals on Wheels duties and didn't have the resources to really help the program thrive. The Community Foundation / United Way in Fort Dodge Ford was able to breathe new life into the Meals on Wheels program, and now many residents in the area receive regular meals. We do 50 to 55 meals a day, Monday through Friday, 52 weeks a year, said Casey Johnson. So tomorrow we'll be delivering Meals on Wheels with a special Thanksgiving treat in it. There are more articles that on the fourth page for this, too. There's a photo of a buffet line, a woman in sort of like a white cardigan and glasses holds out a plate for someone with black gloves to put what looks like what might be like mashed potatoes or eggs on her plate. It's titled, Above, Volunteer Ashley Edge of Fort Dodge gets a plate filled for one of the many guests Thursday at the annual community Thanksgiving dinner at Fort Dodge Ford Lincoln Toyota. There's below this is a photo of a man in a blue button-up with gloves on, putting a pumpkin pie on a plate surrounded by a table that's full of pumpkin pie slices on plates. Left, Rick Brand of Somers is a study in concentration Thursday as he is a study in concentration Thursday as he places slices of pie during the community Thanksgiving dinner at Fort Dodge Ford Lincoln Toyota. And then there's an infographic as well. Fort Dodge Ford Thanksgiving dinner by the numbers, 70 turkeys, 300 pounds of ham, 425 pounds of Yukon gold potatoes, 250 pounds of sweet potatoes, 250 pounds of fresh cranberries, 225 pounds of green beans, 250 pounds of Brussels sprouts, 56 quarts of heavy cream for pie topping, 114 meals delivered, 500 meals served at the showroom. Going back to the first page, sort of squished into a column on the right side is titled Retailers Ready to Kick Off Black Friday. New York, the retailers are kicking off the unofficial start of the holiday shopping season on Friday with a bevy of discounts and other enticements. But executives are growing concerned with a spending slowdown that could temper sales on the day after Thanksgiving as well as throughout the holidays. Shoppers, powered by a solid job market and steady wage growth, have demonstrated a resilience that confounded economists and ran counter to sour sentiments expressed in opinion polls. Such spending, while cautious, came despite higher prices in the grocery aisle and higher borrowing costs. But consumers are now coming under more pressure from dwindling savings, increased credit card debt, and still stubborn inflation. In fact, shoppers cut their buying in October, ending six straight months of gains. Shoppers have gotten some relief from easing inflation, but many goods and services like meat and rent are still far higher than they were just 3 years ago. The latest quarterly results from a string of retailers from Walmart to Best Buy have reported a weakening consumer. Walmart said it noticed shoppers cutting back in October and offered a muted annual sales outlook. Best Buy, the nation's largest retailer, said shoppers are trading down to cheaper TVs, and Target said shoppers are waiting longer to buy items. For example, instead of buying sweatshirts or denim in August or September, they held out until the weather turned cold. It's clear that consumers have been remarkably resilient, Target CEO Brian Cornell told analysts last week. Yet in our research, things like uncertainty, caution, and managing a budget are top of mind. Even luxury retailers are noting their shoppers are feeling pinched. We're taking a measured approach. There's been some softening, said Mark Metrick, CEO of Saks Fifth Avenue standalone online business, Saks. I don't think the holiday season is going to be some horrible business, nor is it going to be some kind of explosive holiday season. The National Retail Federation, the nation's largest retail trade group, expects shoppers will spend more this year than last year, but their pace will slow given all the economic uncertainty. The group has forecast that U.S. holiday sales will rise 3% to 4% for November through December, compared with a 5.4% growth of a year ago. The pace is consistent with the average annual holiday increase of 3.6% from 2010 to pre-pandemic 2019. Americans ramped up spending during the pandemic, with most money in their pockets from federal relief checks and nowhere to go during lockdowns. For the holiday 2021 season, sales for the two-month period surged 12.7%. Many retailers had already ordered fewer goods for this holiday season and have published holiday sales earlier in October than last year to help shoppers spread out their spending. An early shopping push appears to be a trend that only got more pronounced during the pandemic, when clogs in the supply network in 2021 made people buy early for fear of not getting what they wanted. Below this article, it's one titled Lawsuit Claims Insurer Conned Iowa Lawmakers Used Large Malpractice Judgment to Spur Passage of Tort Reform. Article by Clark Kaufman for the Iowa Capital Dispatch. A newly filed lawsuit claims an insurance company engineered a record-setting medical malpractice judgment in Iowa to spur state legislators into passing tort reform legislation. In March 2022, a Johnson County jury awarded more than $97.4 million to the family of a boy who sustained serious brain damage during his birth at an Iowa City hospital. The award, believed to be the largest medical malpractice judgment in Iowa City, was later reduced to $75.6 million. The family's parents, Kathleen and Andrew Krompharts, has had sued Obstetric and Gynecologic Associates of Iowa City and Coralville and others, alleging their son's brain damage was caused by negligence and the hours leading up to its birth in August 2018. Court filings by parties on both sides of the case suggest that the clinic, the doctors, and the family were interested in settling the case out of court for an amount that would be covered by the clinic's insurance policy. The insurance company resisted, however, and rejected proposals to settle the case for any amount, which resulted in the malpractice case going to trial. This week, the client's attorney, Nick Rowley, filed a lawsuit in state court arguing that the insurer, MMIC Insurance / Constellation Incorporated, and its attorneys Shuttleworth and Ingersoll of Cedar Rapids acted in bad faith. MMIC, the lawsuit claims, used the lawsuit and the resulting jury award to persuade state lawmakers to pass tort reform legislation that would save insurance companies millions by capping damages for malpractice that could be paid out to parents and their families. Patients and their families, my bad. Once a jury decided the case was worth $97 million, MMIC Constellation used the jury's verdict to convince Iowa politicians to put a cap on non-economic damages in place in the state of Iowa, the lawsuit claims. MMIC Constellation unreasonably chose not to settle and make the lawsuit and verdict go away, and then used OBGYN Associates' financial and reputational demise as propaganda to pass tort reform in Iowa. MMIC Constellation had been attempting to get a hard non-economic damages cap put in place in Iowa for many years. MMIC Constellation knew that the story of a $97 million verdict and three female OBGYN physicians having to file bankruptcy and close their practice because of a large jury verdict would give MMIC Constellation what it needed to convince Iowa lawmakers to vote to pass the cap. The defendants in the cases have yet to file a response to the lawsuit, but have denied any wrongdoing in related federal court filings. Rowley acknowledged Wednesday that the lawsuit speaks not just to the insurance company's actions, but to its motives. But he said he doesn't anticipate it will be a difficult case to prove. "I don't think it's going to be that tough," he said. "A jury is going to see what happened. It's right there. It's right out in the open, because that's how bold they are in Iowa. And wait until I get all their emails and their text messages and everything. We're going to look at everything and leave no stone unturned." Lawsuit. Governor and lawmakers lobbied. The allegations in the lawsuit echoes those made in court filings related to the original malpractice lawsuit and the client's bankruptcy. In relation to those filings, Rowley claimed the insurer's decision to take the case to trial rather than settle was part of predetermined strategy of forcing the clinic into bankruptcy, enabling lobbyists and lawmakers to claim tort reform was needed to save medical providers from moving out of Iowa. The bankruptcy element of the plan was almost successful, Rowley claims, until a federal judge in the bankruptcy case stepped in and dismissed the case as fraudulent. The newly filed lawsuit claims that in the wake of the record-setting judgment, MMIC Constellation held seminars and lobbied for the implementation of non-economic caps in Iowa. Involving the governor in the process, MMIC Constellation told the story of three female OBGYN physicians who had to file for bankruptcy and close down their clinic because of greedy trial lawyers and out-of-control civil litigation in Iowa. What MMIC Constellation failed to share in these seminars and meetings with Iowa lawmakers is the fact that MMIC Constellation was the insurer in the case of the $97 million verdict and all of the other large jury verdicts in Iowa, and that each case went to trial because MMIC Constellation refused to negotiate and settle reasonably. House File 161 capped non-economic damages in lawsuits against healthcare providers for medical incidents that result in the loss of impairment of a bodily function, disfigurement, or death, and $1 million for clinics and individual doctors and $2 million for hospitals. Rowley has argued that MMIC Constellation, in executing the alleged scheme to bamboozle state legislators, repeatedly put its own financial and political interests ahead of its policyholder, the clinic, which it used as a pawn to change Iowa law regarding non-economic damages, telling Iowans at best half-truths and at worst straight-up lies. The bad faith runs deep and will prove to be one of the worst cases of bad faith conduct justifying punitive damages in Iowa state history. Rowley said Wednesday that the insurance companies have been playing the long game and focusing on long-term profits rather than short-term losses. They sit up there on their high insurance company thrones and they see the world through a whole different lens than the rest of us, Raleigh said. Judge questioned bankruptcy filing. The lawsuit seeks unspecified damages for bad faith, legal malpractice, breach of fiduciary duty, and breach of contract. The new litigation follows an aborted bankruptcy filing by the clinic last fall. The Cromparts' attorneys had challenged the filing, arguing it was filed in bad faith to avoid payment of the malpractice award. On January 20th, the conservator in the bankruptcy case filed a motion with the court alleging the clinic was acting in bad faith by filing for bankruptcy and arguing it was a litigation tactic to avoid payment of a bond that would secure some of the clinic's assets. In a March 29th decision dismissing the bankruptcy case, U.S. bankruptcy judge Anita L. Shodin expressed concern over the relationship between the clinic and its insurer, MMC. The judge suggested the insurance company may have been given the clinic certain financial favors in return for the clinic filing for bankruptcy as part of an effort to shield MMIC from having to make a $12 million policy payout. She noted that MMIC paid fees to the clinic's bankruptcy professionals and offered the clinic favorable terms on its insurance coverage when no one else would. In addition, the judge stated MMIC had offered to extend credit to the clinic. A question arises about whether the bankruptcy was motivated by a proper purpose or to obtain financial advantages from MMIC in exchange for filing bankruptcy to attempt to protect it from making payment under the policy, Shodin stated in her decision. That seems to be it for the first page. Moving on to the second. Macy's Thanksgiving parade ushers in holiday season in New York. New York. Beloved characters like Snoopy and SpongeBob SquarePants soared through the skies above New York City on Thursday, and bands marched along the streets below as the annual Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade ushered in the holiday season. The parade started on Manhattan's Upper West Side, making its way alongside Central Park in front of big crowds in a national television audience before ending in front of Macy's flagship store on 34th Street. Among the big names performing was Cher, who just released her first Christmas album. The Oscar, Emmy, and Grammy Award winner had a prime spot, performing just before the arrival of Santa Claus, which marks the end of the parade. Other celebrities and musical groups taking part included Jon Baptiste, Belle Biv DeVoe, Brandy, Jesse James Decker, Pentatonix, and Miss America 2023 Grace Stank. The parade also included performances from the cast of some Broadway shows. The parade was briefly disrupted about a half dozen protesters in jumpsuits covered in fake blood glued themselves to the street just in front of a float carrying characters from the fast food giant McDonald's. They carried a banner that said Free Palestine and Genocide Then, Genocide Now, and were taken into custody. The parade continued as police worked. New balloons debuting the year included Leo the Lizard, a character from a Netflix film who is more than 40 feet tall, as well as one that has been there before, like SpongeBob, coming in at 44 feet. Some characters, like Snoopy, have been in the parade for many years, but this year's balloon is a new Beagle Scout Snoopy version, celebrating the 50th anniversary of his first appearance in the Peanuts comics. The parade isn't just about what's going on in the skies, though. At street level, the floats, interspersed with marching bands from around the country and a number of clown crews, among the 8,000 people participating, organizers said. There, above, sort of in the corner here, is a column titled Three Remain Missing in Alaska Landslide by Wrangell, Alaska. Searchers looking for three people who remain missing after a massive landslide that killed three others and injured a fourth have changed their strategy from holding an active search to a reactive search that will involve methodically clearing the highway, officials said Thursday. During active search periods, we have searchers in the field meticulously looking for missing persons. Austin McDaniel, a spokesperson with the Alaska Department for Public Safety, told the Associated Press, during reactive searches, search teams are not actively in the field, but will react to new information and then actively search that area supported by the new information. Since Monday night's slide, officials have inspected the site by air with drones, helicopters, and planes, while teams using detection dogs and sonar covered the ground and water. But the three people, one adult and two juveniles, remain missing, McDaniel said. The slide churned up the earth from near the top of the mountain down to the ocean, tearing down a wide swath of evergreen trees and burying a highway in the island's community of Wrangell, about 155 miles south of Juneau. Rescue crews found the body of a girl in an initial search Monday night and the bodies of two adults late Tuesday. Around 52 homes are cut off from town by the landslide. Roughly 35 to 45 people have chosen to stay in that area, interim borough manager Masonville Arma said. Boats are being used to provide supplies, including food, fuel, and water, and prescription medications to those residents. Given the geography of the island, with a town at the northern part point and houses along a 13-mile stretch of paved road, currently the ocean is our only access to those residents, he said. Wrangell usually celebrates Thanksgiving with a tree lighting and downtown shopping events, but could replace that with a Virgil, he said. In that way, the town can come together physically and recognize the tragedy and the loss of life, but also the triumph of a small community that's really come together and been able to pull off some remarkable successes, even in the face of all of this adversity, Villarma said in a phone interview. Hello, this is a recording of the November 24th edition of the Mason City Globe Gazette. On the first page, the front article is titled, Ceasefire Set to Begin for the Israel-Hamas War. Beneath the header is a photo of a city under a gray sky. The city is largely in ruins with a big plume of smoke erupting from the left-hand side. There's one apartment building that looks relatively intact, but another besides it that is pretty much squished. It's captioned, Smoke rises Thursday following an Israeli bombardment in the Gaza Strip, as seen from southern Israel. First hostages in Gaza to be freed. Palestinian toll tops 13,300. Article by Wafa Sharafa, Najib Jobain, and Jack Jeffrey for the Associated Press. Deir al-Balah, Gaza Strip. A four-day ceasefire in Gaza between Israel and Hamas was set to begin Friday morning. Qatar said after a day-long delay extended the agony for those hoping for some relief from the deal, which is to bring the release of dozens of hostages held by militants and Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. The diplomatic breakthrough promised some relief for the 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza who have endured weeks of Israeli bombardment, as well as families in Israel fearful for the fate of their loved ones taken captive during Hamas's October 7th attack that triggered the war. The ceasefire was originally set to begin Thursday morning, but it appeared to hit a snag the night before when Israel's national security advisor, Tzvi Hagenby, announced a one-day delay without providing a reason. On Thursday, Qatari Foreign Ministry spokesman Majad Al Ansari announced the ceasefire will start at 7 a.m. local time Friday, 5 a.m. GMT. He said the two sides have exchanged lists of those to be released, and the first group of 13 women and children held by Hamas would be freed Friday afternoon. He did not say how many Palestinian prisoners would be free, but officials have said 3 would be freed for every hostage. Increased aid for Palestinians will start to enter Gaza as soon as possible, Al Ansari said. The hope is that the momentum from the deal will lead to an end to this violence, he told reporters. Israeli airstrikes continued Thursday. In the afternoon, a strike leveled a residential building in the Nusayrat, Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. At least 12 people were killed, according to officials at nearby Al-Aqsa Hospital. One resident, Azni Moharib, said his wife and several children were killed and other relatives remained buried under rubble. It exploded on the house, striking the babies and young children. Everyone in the house, they are all dead, he said, bursting into tears. The Israeli bombardment, now in its 7th week, has killed more than 13,300 Palestinians, according to the health ministry in Hamas-ruled Gaza, which resumed its detailed count of casualties in Gaza from the war. The ministry had stopped publishing casualty counts since November 11th, saying it had lost the ability to do so because of the health system's collapse in the north. The new numbers were not fully broken down, but women and minors have consistently made up around 2/3 of the dead. The figures do not include updated numbers from hospitals in the north. The ministry says some 6,000 people have been reported missing, feared buried under rubble. The ministry does not differentiate between civilians and militants in its death tolls. Israel said it has killed thousands of Hamas fighters without presenting evidence for its count. The truce agreement raised hopes of eventually winding down the war, which has leveled vast swaths of Gaza, fueled a surge of violence in the occupied West Bank, and stirred fears of a wider conflagration across the Middle East. Air raid sirens sounded across northern Israel on Thursday, as Hezbollah said it fired 48 Katyusha rockets from southern Lebanon. The barrage came after an Israeli strike killed 5 Hezbollah fighters, including the son of the head of the group's parliamentary bloc. The Israeli military said it was striking the sources of the launches. Israel and Hezbollah, which fought a month-long war in 2006, have repeatedly traded fire across the border since the war in Gaza broke down. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to continue the war after the truce expires to destroy Hamas's military capabilities, end its 16-year rule in Gaza, and return all the estimated 240 captives held in Gaza by Hamas and other groups. We will continue it until we achieve all our goals, Netanyahu said, adding that he had delivered the same message in a phone call to President Joe Biden. Washington has provided extensive military and diplomatic support to Israel since the start of the war. The Israeli military had said combat operations would continue until it was ordered to hold fire, and Chief Spokesman Rear Administrator, it's ADM period, Daniel Hagari, said troops would remain in place during the truce. Israeli forces hold much of northern Gaza, where they say they have dismantled tunnels and much of Hamas's infrastructure there. The military said it has surrounded the Jabalia refugee camp and called on any residents inside to evacuate Thursday. The military has said it is pursuing Hamas's fighters in Jabalia, a dense urban district adjacent to Gaza City that's been heavily bombarded for weeks. The military said Thursday it detained the director of Gaza City's Shifa Hospital, Mohammed Abu Salmiya, for questioning over his involvement in what is called extensive Hamas activity in the hospital. Gaza's health ministry condemned Abu Salmiya's arrest and called on international bodies to intervene. For Hamas, the ceasefire would provide an opportunity to regroup after weeks of apparently heavy losses. Hamas leader Yahya, that's Yehya Sinwar, who is believed to be alive and in hiding in Gaza, is likely to claim the release of Palestinian prisoners as a major achievement and declare victory if the war ends. Below this article, on the first page, is an article titled, "Poll, Nearly Half of Americans Say Ukraine Spending Too High." Article by Seung, S-E-U-N-G, Min Kim, and Lindley Sanders for the Associated Press. It has a photo of a man in like military gear with like a camera attached to his helmet. He carries a rifle with a scope. He's on a boat and the boat is sailing down a river behind like another boat that's off in the distance. And it's titled Ukrainian Soldiers Navigate on the Dnipro River. Dnipro River, on June 11th at the front line near Kherson, Ukraine. Close to half of the U.S. public thinks the country is spending too much on aid to Ukraine, a new poll finds. Washington. As lawmakers in Washington weigh sending billions more in federal support to Kyiv to fight off Russian aggression, close to half of the U.S. public thinks the country is spending too much on aid to Ukraine, according to polling from the Associated Press, NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. Those sentiments, driven primarily by Republicans, help explain the hardening opposition among conservative GOP lawmakers on Capitol Hill, who are rebuffing efforts from President Joe Biden to approve a new tranche of Ukraine aid, arguing that the money would be better spent for domestic priorities. Yet opposition to aid is down slightly from where it was a month ago in another AP NORC poll. Now, 45% say the U.S. government is spending too much on aid to Ukraine in the war against Russia, compared with 52% in October. That shift appears to come mostly from Republicans. 59% now say too much is spent on Ukraine aid, but that's down from 69% in October. Nonetheless, the Republican resistance to continued Ukraine aid remains strong. I understand the civilians need help, but I feel like we're spending way too much money on Ukraine when we have our issues here on our own soil that we need to deal with, said Eric Mondello, 40, from Fountain, Colorado, pointing to needs such as health care for veterans and homelessness in communities. Mondello added, I understand the U.S. has been an ally to others, but I feel like let's take care of our people first. More than one-third, 38% of U.S. adults say that current spending is about the right amount, which is up slightly from last month, 31%. Among Republicans, nearly 3 in 10, 29%, say the current spending is about right, up from 20% last month. The White House has been repeatedly pressing lawmakers to pass Biden's nearly $1.6 billion emergency spending package that he proposed in October, which includes more than $61 billion specifically for the war in Ukraine. The rest of Biden's request has aid for Israel as it battles Hamas, money for various priorities in the Indo-Pacific region, and additional resources to help manage migration at the southern border. On Ukraine, the Biden administration is increasingly warning that the well of aid is running dry. In an unannounced visit to Kyiv on Monday, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Ukraine's effort to defeat Russian forces matters to the rest of the world and pledged that U.S. support would continue for the long haul. The message was reinforced at the White House. As President Biden has said, when aggressors don't pay a price for their aggression, they'll cause more chaos and death and destruction. John Kirby, spokesman for the National Security Council, told the White House press briefing Monday. They just keep on going, and the cost and the threats to America and to the world will keep rising. But Congress has rebuffed the White House's efforts at bolstering Ukraine support at least twice in recent months. First, it ignored a roughly $40 billion supplemental request from it before a September 30th funding deadline. Then last week, it passed a stopgap funding measure that keeps the government operating through early next year, but with no additional Ukraine aid. In the Senate, a small bipartisan group is working on legislation that would combine fresh Ukraine assistance with stricter border measures to address concerns from Republicans that the U.S. was focused on needs abroad at the expense of issues closer to home. A broad majority of senators remains supportive of Ukraine aid, with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell being one of the most stalwart supporters despite the isolationist strain to his party. South Dakota Senator John Thune, the number two Republican in the Senate, said lawmakers will continue to work on the Ukraine border package over the Thanksgiving break and won't wait until mid-January when Congress faces another government funding deadline to act on Ukraine. The big question mark is in the House, where still new Speaker Mike Johnson, who had voted against Ukraine aid as a rank-and-file conservative, has spoken broadly of the need to counter Russian aggression, yet faces unruly GOP lawmakers who have shown more hostility to continued support for Kyiv. Johnson, too, is insisting that additional Ukraine aid be paired with tougher border measures, although it is far from certain that any immigration agreement that clears the Democratic-led Senate could pass the GOP-controlled House. Half of U.S. adults are extremely or very concerned that Russia's influence poses a direct threat to the United States. Democrats, 53%, and Republicans, 51%, are similarly concerned about Russian power, but Democrats are more likely than Republicans to see Ukraine as a nation of shared values to the U.S. and to support more aid for Ukraine. About half of the public, 48%, endorses providing weapons to Ukraine, 57% among Democrats, 42% among Republicans. About 4 in 10 favor sending government funds directly to Ukraine, 54% for Democrats, 24% for Republicans. Americans have grown slightly more likely to say the U.S. should take a less active role in solving the world's problems, compared with a September poll from APNORC and Pearson. Slightly fewer than half, 45%, now say the U.S. should be less involved, up from 33% in September. Just 16% of Democrats now say the U.S. should take a more active role, down from 29% in September. On the second page is an article titled, Can Black Friday Deals Lure Hesitant Shoppers? Retailers' fear spending pullback could temper holiday season sales. Article by Anne the Innocencio by the Associated Press, for the Associated Press. There's a photo of a shopping mall. One of the displays is a shelf done up to look like a pink truck. There are Christmas trees sort of in the background as well by the shelves, and fake snow flakes tied to the ceiling. And it's captioned, shoppers look over holiday merchandise on display at a Target store Wednesday in Orlando, Florida. New York. Retailers are kicking off the unofficial start of the holiday shopping season on Friday with a bevy of discounts and other enticements. But executives are growing concerned with a spending slowdown that could temper sales on the day after Thanksgiving, as well as throughout the holidays. Shoppers, powered by a solid job market and steady wage growth, have demonstrated a resilience that confounded economists and ran counter to sour sentiments expressed in opinion polls. Such spending, while cautious, came despite higher prices in the grocery aisle and higher borrowing costs. But consumers are now coming under more pressure from dwindling savings, increased credit card debt, and still stubborn inflation. In fact, shoppers cut their buying in October, ending 6 straight months of gains. Shoppers have gotten some relief from easing inflation, but many goods and services like meat and rent are still far higher than they were just 3 years ago. The latest quarterly results from a string of retailers from Walmart to Best Buy have reported a weakening consumer. Walmart said it noted shoppers cutting back in October and offered a muted annual sales outlook. Best Buy, the nation's largest retailer, said shoppers are trading down to cheaper TVs, and Target said shoppers are waiting longer to buy items. For example, instead of buying sweatshirts or denim back in August or September, they held out until the weather turned cold. It's clear that consumers have been remarkably resilient, Target CEO Brian Cornell said, told analysts last week. Yet in our research, things like uncertainty, caution, and managing a budget are top of mind. Even luxury retailers are noting their shoppers are feeling pinched. "You're taking a measured approach. There's been some softening," said Mark Metrick, CEO of Saks Fifth Avenue's standalone online business, Saks. "I don't think the holiday season is going to be some horrible business, nor is it going to be some kind of explosive holiday season." The National Retail Federation, the nation's largest retail trade group, expects shoppers will spend more this year than last year, but their pace will slow given all the economic uncertainty. The group has forecast that U.S. holiday sales will rise 3% to 4% for November through December, compared with a 5.4% growth of a year ago. The pace is consistent with the average annual holiday increase of 3.6% from 2010 to pre-pandemic 2019. Americans ramped up spending during the pandemic with more money in their pockets from federal relief checks and nowhere to go during lockdown. For the holiday 2021 season, sales for the two-month period surged 12.7%. Many retailers had already ordered fewer goods for this holiday season and have pushed holiday sales earlier in October than last year to help shoppers spread out their spending. An early shopping push appears to be a trend that only got more pronounced during the pandemic, when clogs in the supply network in 2021 made people buy early for fear of not getting what they wanted. But retailers said that many shoppers will be focusing more on deals and will likely wait until the last minute. Best Buy said it's pushing more items at opening price points, while Kohl's has simplified its deals, promoting items under a certain price point, like $25, at its stores. Online discounts should be better than a year ago, particularly for toys, electronics, and clothing, according to Adobe Analytics, which tracks online spending. It predicts toys will be discounted on average by 35%, compared with 22% a year ago, while electronics should see 30% cuts, compared with last year's 27%. In clothing, shoppers will see an average discount of 25%, compared with 19% last year, Adobe said. Analysts consider the 5-day Black Friday weekend, which includes the Monday after the holiday known as Cyber Monday, a key barometer of shoppers' willingness to spend. And Black Friday is expected to be once again the busiest shopping day of the year, according to Sensormatic Solutions, firm that tracks store traffic. On average, the top 10 busiest shopping days in the U.S. are expected to once again account for roughly 40% of all holiday retail traffic, Sensormatic said. Stores have been increasingly pushing Black Friday-type deals all month, helping to perk up business. Adobe Analytics reported that from November 1st through Monday, consumers spent $63.2 billion online, up to 5% compared with the year-ago period, and outpacing its estimate of 4.8% for the two-month holiday period. However, Marshall Cohen, chief retail advisor at Circana, a market research firm, said he thinks that shoppers will just stick to a list and not buy on impulse. He also believes they will take their time buying throughout the season. "There's no sense of urgency," Cohen said. "The consumers are saying, I will stop when it's convenient to me." Since most of the second page with just continuations of articles from the first. Moving on to Article 3, which is Nation and World. The front article up in the right-hand corner is titled Illness Spikes in China, Potential for Global Outbreak After COVID Prompts Rare Request, article by Jamie Keaton and Maria Cheng for the Associated Press. Geneva. Chinese officials say they did not detect any unusual or novel diseases in the country. The World Health Organization said Thursday, following an official request by the UN Health Agency for information about a potentially worrying spike in respiratory illnesses and clusters of pneumonia in children, who cited unspecified media reports in the Global Infectious Disease Monitoring Service as reporting clusters of undiagnosed pneumonia in children in northern China and formally requested more details from China earlier this week. Outside scientists said the situation warranted close monitoring, but were not convinced that the recent spikes in respiratory illnesses in China signaled the start of a new global outbreak. The emergence of new flu strains or other viruses capable of triggering pandemics typically starts with undiagnosed clusters of respiratory illness. Both SARS and COVID-19 were first reported as unusual types of pneumonia. WHO noted that authorities at China's National Health Commission on November 13th reported an increase in respiratory diseases, which they said was due to the lifting of COVID-19 lockdown restrictions. Other countries also saw a jump in respiratory diseases such as respiratory syncytial, SYNCYTIAL virus, or RSV, when pandemic restrictions ended. WHO said media reports about a week later reported clusters of undiagnosed pneumonia in children in northern China. The UN agency said it held a teleconference with Chinese health officials Thursday, during which the data it requested were provided. Those showed an increase in hospital admissions of children due to diseases including bacterial infection, RSV, influenza, and common cold viruses since October. Dr. Paul Hunter, a professor of medicine at Britain's University of East Anglia, doubted the wave of infections were sparked by a new disease. If it was a new disease, I would expect to see many more infections in adults, he said in a statement. The few infections reported in adults suggested existing immunity from a prior exposure. Francois Ballaux, B-A-L-L-O-U-X, of University College London, said China was probably experiencing a significant wave of childhood infections since this was the first winter since lockdown restrictions were lifted, which likely reduced children's immunity to common bugs. WHO said that northern China has reported a jump in influenza-like illnesses since mid-October compared to the previous 3 years. It is rare for the UN Health Agency to publicly ask for more detailed information from countries, as such requests are typically made internally. According to internal accounts in China, the outbreak has swamped some hospitals in northern China, including in Beijing. The average number of patients in the internal medicine department at Beijing Children's Hospital topped 7,000 per day, exceeding the hospital's capacity, state-owned China National Radio said. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed, food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.